hope you got something out of that. It was great. I loved listening to it, and it's like we were on the same page. I'll be using a commentary written by Gareth Rees. He did a when I taught Galatians, I used his commentary, and I was very impressed with it. And so far, I'm very impressed with his commentary for Hebrews. It's very informative. So we'll just be looking at the first four verses today, but there's so much to look at in the first four verses of Hebrews. It's just amazing what is said in these first four verses that gives us just so much to delve into as far as what the writer here is saying about Jesus. And these first four verses are focused on one thing, and that is that Jesus is superior to the prophets. And so that's what we're going to be spending our time on tonight, is looking at how Jesus is superior to the prophets. So if there's a theme, and Dina disclosed a theme last week, but I would add to it this sentence. If there's a theme of Hebrews, I think it would be this. That is to let the superiority of the Son of God and the revelation God gave through Jesus motivate you to continued faithfulness to Christianity. That is the whole of what Hebrews is about. The theme of Hebrews is just this. That is to, it is a motivation for, as it was disclosed last week, for the Jews of the time to be motivated to continue in Christianity, not to fall back into that trap of the law and of what they had been doing in the last 1500 years of their lives, and that is the Mosaic law. That had been done away with. Jesus fulfilled that in his sacrifice and his his mission on earth. And we're going to be looking at that in these first four verses tonight. What we can see is that God made, or God's developing revelations were made through the prophets. When we look back through the Old Testament, we can see one thing that God has spoken. God spoke in various ways and at different times. And God spoke regularly to the patriarchs. God spoke through his prophets after the patriarchal age and as we entered into the Mosaic age. But one thing that we can say about God is that he is not silent. God continues to speak. He is omnipotent. That means he is all-knowing. He is the organizer of things as they are. God has prepared this universe to run in a certain way. And it does. He has set things in motion and they stay that way. He holds them together through the power of his word. He is omniscient. He is all-knowing of things past, present, and future. And he has revealed himself to us through his word. We can see that so many times throughout the Old and New Testament that when God speaks, it happens. We see that God spoke and there was light. All he had to say was, "Let there be light." He didn't say, "Let there be a star, let there be a sun." He merely said, "Let there be light." And there was light. That light, who knows what the source was? It doesn't matter. The light was what God said, "Let there be light." And God's developing revelations were made through the prophets after he spoke long ago. So as we continue through, I'm going to grab my Bible here. Hold on just a second. I think I put it down. Yeah, here it is. So as we continue through these first four verses of Hebrews, we can see that he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets. That is that God chose the prophets to be the mouthpiece for him throughout many of the old age. Get into where I wanted to read that. Give me just a second here. So all the ages before the coming of Christ, that's how God chose to speak. He's again through the to the patriarchs, he spoke to them directly, but after that he chose to speak through the prophets. And so we see prophets in the patriarchal age, in the Mosaic age, and in the Christian age. And we'll look at some examples of that in just a minute. So a prophet is one who speaks for God and who speaks by inspiration. And so what we might say is that God used the prophets to make his word known. God spoke face to face with the patriarchs and through prophets like Enoch. We can read about Enoch being a prophet in Jude. There's only one chapter, so but in Jude 14 you can read about Enoch. He was a prophet, a patriarchal prophet. God spoke through prophets like Moses and Samuel in the Mosaic age. And long ago, maybe God's older revelation was no longer sufficient and a newer one was needed. So, as we are reading through this first verse, it reads, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets. That's leading us up to something new, something that was going to change. So long ago he did that, but now it's going to be different. And so it also says in many portions and in many ways. God revealed himself a little bit at a time in previous ages. We didn't get the entire message that God wanted to reveal all at once. It took thousands of years for God to reveal his entire message. And he did that a little bit at a time, through prophets, through the patriarchs, speaking directly to some, and revealing himself to others in dreams and visions. So his will was revealed progressively as time went on. No one person or prophet revealed his will entirely. God used a plethora of these people to reveal his will to all mankind. From Adam to Malachi, God revealed himself a piece at a time. And many ways would show us that God used different means to reveal himself. He used dreams, like I said earlier. He used visions, direct communication, object lessons, and many other things that he did. We know that God spoke through dumb animals. We can read about examples of that. And God spoke through the whirlwind. He used many different forms of communication to reveal himself. And God culminated his revelation in his son. It says, in these last days. And that is the Christian age. The Christian age is the last age, and it culminates in his word he would have us to know completely revealed. So everything we need to know about God has been revealed in his word. There is nothing that we didn't know about God that we cannot read about him that has been revealed by his prophets or through the apostles in the New Testament. Is spoken to us in his son. No form or person God spoke to in previous times compares to his revelation through Jesus, his son. The Old Testament was precursory. It was awaiting fulfillment in the Messiah. We read that God has spoken, and that's because it was awaiting fulfillment in Jesus. So let's look at some of the evidence of the Son's superiority.
Hey, Ted,
Yeah.
two thoughts occurs to me. The first is that when he says he has spoken, that's past tense. So he's not continuing to reveal himself like he did in the Old Testament. And the thing that I see as so very important is if we're right, and this is written to Jews who have to listen to their mom at Passover dinner say, "Why have you rejected what God said?" He acknowledges that what you read from Moses came from God. It's
Right.
just that this was the culmination of that.
Excellent. An excellent point. And what we see in these first two sentences of Hebrews is the fact that we're looking at the past. We're starting with the past, looking at what God was leading up to. And that is the fact that the entire purpose of God's revelation through Adam to Malachi and into the New Testament era before Christ died, the entire purpose of God revealing himself was to reveal his son, was to show the superiority of his son. And so Hebrews, it's amazing that there's so much in these first four verses that show the evidence of the son's superiority. And this is just the son's superiority to the prophets. So we're going to look at eight different evidences of the son's superiority. So he said, whom he appointed heir of all things. So the first evidence is that Jesus was the heir of all things. It proves Jesus' exalted position. It's a title of dignity. And it shows that Jesus is supreme. The appointment was made in eternity before creation. God's plan is like God. It always was, is, and will be. This is how it was made. When we talk about these things coming to be, creation, well, the Godhead, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit were planning these things in eternity before we were ever even could even think that we were conceived. They were planning for us. They were planning not only the creation of the universe, but the fact that there would need to be a propitiation for sin for these beings that were created after the image of God. That God knew that we would not be sinless, that we would fail, and that we would need his help. And that plan was put into place before God even said, let there be light. So another evidence of the son's superiority, it goes on to say, through whom he also made the world. Well, before the son took on a mortal body, he was active helping the Father create the world and all that's in it and around it. That Greek word, world, it can be translated two different ways, world or age. And so the plural of that would be worlds or ages. And they were, God was a creator. His son was a co-creator. The Holy Spirit was a co-creator of the world and everything in and around it. And Jesus divine in Jesus being divine in nature puts him so far above any prophet. He is already standing out as superior when compared to the prophets of old. But the other thing you can look at with that word, aeonis, or that Greek word world, is that it can also be translated age. Equally, if the word is translated age, Jesus was the agent who determined when the ages began and ended. Again, far above the purview of any prophet. No one man would ever be able to say that they were responsible for creating that Mosaic age or that patriarchal age or that when that age changed from one to another. The prophets were not responsible for that. They played a part in God's ministry. They were his mouthpiece, but they were not the ones who were responsible for those things to happen. Jesus was. Jesus was responsible for the creation of the physical world and was the agent who determined when the ages began and ended. That was his responsibility. The third evidence of his superiority started in the next verse. In verse 3, it says, "And he is the radiance of his glory." Jesus is the radiance of God's glory. He exudes the glory of God. When we look at that, this is that well-known description of whenever you see a picture, an artist's conception of the throne of God, that is that dazzling sphere of light that is seen of God on his throne. We can read about that in Revelation chapter 4, verses 2 through 6. If somebody has their Bible, I would love to have somebody read those verses for me.
You want me to read it, Ted?
Sure, go ahead.
3 through 6.
We'll read Revelation 4, verses 2 through 6.
"Immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne was standing in heaven, and one sitting on the throne. And he who was sitting was like a jasper stone and a sardis in appearance, and there was a rainbow around the throne like an emerald in appearance. Around the throne were 24 thrones, and upon the throne..."
Did we lose her?
Yeah.
Out from the throne came flashes of lightning and sounds of peals of thunder, and there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. And before the throne there was something like a sea of glass, like crystal, and in the center and around the throne, four living creatures full of eyes in front and behind.
Okay. Gives us just an idea of what John witnessed, of that dazzling sphere of light, that immense glory that God exudes. We also see that description of Jesus in Matthew chapter 17 and verse 2, when we see his transfiguration. We see this description of Jesus as well on the road to Damascus. That light shining from heaven that blinded Paul, and that light that made it so he could not see anything. Jesus shines with this light, just like the Father does. No prophet can claim that. Not even Moses can claim that. He reflected a glow which lasted only a while when he descended from Mount Sinai. But he did not shine with the glory of God like Jesus does. Jesus, as the verse continues, is the exact representation of his nature. So Jesus is an exact likeness to all that one finds in the Father. And the word nature there is a better translation than the King James Version person. It implies the constituent elements of which something is made. The elements one finds in the Father are found in the Son. They match exactly. If the Father is omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, infinitely holy, wise, just, and good, then so is the Son. He is the exact representation of God's nature. That's just an amazing description of him. The fifth evidence of the Son's superiority to the prophets is as the verse continues, and upholds all things by the word of his power. The Son is superior to prophets because he is responsible for sustaining this universe in its existence and operation, and for maintaining it until it arrives at the consummation God has planned. We can read about that in Colossians chapter 1 and verses 16 through 20, if I can get a volunteer to read those verses.
For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is also head of the body, the church, and he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself will come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him I say, whether things on earth or things in heaven.
All right. What better description can we have of Christ as the center of all things? That makes him so far superior to any prophet. Jesus does this merely by speaking, for his word is just that powerful. When he was there in the beginning, they said, "Let there be light," and there was light, because he spoke. And just the same, his word holds the universe together. He says, hold together or move, and it does. That is in his power. His word is power. The sixth evidence of Jesus' superiority to prophets, the prophets, is when he had made a purification of sins. Christ's redemptive work on the cross of Calvary was something no prophet could do. Purification of sins was the work of a priest. This is going to introduce a theme in Hebrews, that is Jesus' high priesthood. And we're going to see that theme throughout this book. He came to earth to deal with a sin problem, with a once for all sacrifice that only he could perform. Hebrews is also going to introduce the idea that neither the Levitical priesthood nor animal blood could remove sin. That is something that only Jesus could do. And so we read about that here in this verse, when he had made purification of sins. That's not his sin. That's the sin of every other human that's ever walked on this planet. The seventh evidence is that he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Jesus sits at the highest place of honor and authority in the universe after finishing his redemptive work. This was predicted in the Old Testament. We can read about that in Psalm 110 and verse 1, where David says precisely that. The fact that Jesus sat down indicates that he had finished his atoning work for sin. He had no other work that he needed to do, because it had been completed. He as much as said that on the cross. All things had been fulfilled in him. No prophet or priest would ever sit in God's presence, nor were they an equal with God that they would be seated at his right hand. Only Jesus earned that honor, because he was truly the Son of God. And the eighth and final evidence of the Son's superiority to the prophets is having become so much better than the angels. The Hebrew writer introduces two new ideas here that that he's going to weave throughout the book. And we'll be looking a lot more next week at this idea of Jesus' superiority to the angels. But these two new ideas are this, and Dean touched on this last week, the word better. That word is used 13 times in this book. It's only used 19 times in the New Testament. So the majority of that word appears in the book of Hebrews. And then better than the angels. Jesus was made a little lower than the angels as a man to make purification of sins. He is no longer lower than the angels. He was not lower in eternity before creation, nor is he now. He is superior to them, but for a short time, as a man, to make purification of sins, he was made a little lower than the angels. And this is to the extent that he has inherited a more excellent name than they. The name Jesus inherited in this concept, in this context we're looking at, is Son. God called him his son. In our time, names just distinguish us from one another. But in times past, a name summed up a person's character. It was the defining thing about that person. Jesus' time of earthly humiliation led to his exaltation by the Father when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand. Jesus obtained this more excellent name by a fulfillment of all that the Father had asked him to do. Only Jesus has earned this name in this sense, the Son of God. We can read about us being sons and daughters of God, but not in the same sense as Jesus. We are not sitting on the right hand of God. Only one being has done that. That is Jesus Christ. He earned that. He did exactly what he was meant to do. He gave up his eternal divinity for a short time, not his entire godhood, because as we can see and read about him, when he was on this earth, he had that glory within him. He had the power over nature. His word meant things. His word could stop the storm. His word was able to cure sick people. He could say, "Arise," to a dead person, and they would be living yet again. It was his word that was powerful, even when he was in human form. But the evidence we have here through these first four verses show just how much more superior Jesus was than the prophets. Next week, we're going to be looking at Jesus is superior to the angels. We'll be looking at chapter 1, verse 5 through chapter 2, verses 18. If we make it through all of that, we'll see. That's a lot to cover. It may take us a couple weeks to look at it. But none of us would argue that the angels are superior to mankind. We've seen the messengers of God come and the power that they exhibit when they were delivering messages to people in the Old and New Testament. We know that they are powerful beings, but Jesus is superior to them. And we're going to see that defined next week as we look at that. Are there any comments or questions about what we've just looked at in these first four verses?
Yeah, Ted, I think there's a lot to be learned about Jesus and his relationship to the Godhead, when the apostles asked him, show us the Father. And he said, have I been with you so long and you've not seen him yet? In other words, I can't show you the Father other than just by being who I am. That's how you understand the Father. And so we got to see, you know, I have this phrase that I use a lot, Jesus is God with skin on. And I think there's a lot of value to that. We know how God is relating to us because we know how Jesus related to us.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I've read these first four verses of Hebrews so many times, and you kind of skim over them, but man, when you dig into these verses and see just how descriptive the writer is of the superiority of Jesus, how superior he was, and just the mere power of God and what God accomplished through his son on this earth. It is just amazing to me that we take for granted what God has given us and what God gave us in Jesus. That he was willing to send his son to this planet, giving up part of his eternal power to be in skin with us, is just amazing to me.
And he doesn't, when he says this, he doesn't denigrate the priests. They had a function. He doesn't denigrate the angels. They had a function. And they're powerful beings. He's just saying that Jesus is superior to them. And that's what the Jewish boy had to respond to his mom.
Absolutely. And this is a great way to start a conversation for a Jew who had become a Christian who wants to explain why. Why did I give up my entire traditional livelihood, my entire family tradition of sacrifice and keeping festivals and all of these things to be a Christian, to follow this man named Christ? And he can say to his family, look at this man. He was God in the flesh, and he came here for me. He came here to save all of us. Whether you believe it or not, whether you care for it or not, he died for you. And he died for me. He died for all of us. Because he was the only one who could. A perfect sacrifice. Any other comments?
Ted?
I have a comment.
Yes.
Lee wants
Go ahead,
to,
girl.
Lee wants to say something. Go ahead, Lee.
I just wanted to tell you, Ted, that I feel very privileged after reading all of this and listening to the definitions of all of what's been said. I feel very privileged.
I think we all should. I agree with you wholeheartedly. If it doesn't bring a tear to your eye to read these first four verses and just think of what you've been given, what was accomplished through Jesus for you, then you may want to dig a little harder to find your heart, because I can't tell you how many times it brought me almost to tears to study these first four verses, because it's just amazing what we can find in Jesus, the power, the authority, but yet the humbleness, the willingness to give himself up for us. This was the God who created everything, yet he was willing to be spat upon. Any other comments?
Ted, who wrote the book? You said the commentary. What was the man's name?
His name is Gareth Reese, R-E-E-S-E.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's a New Testament epistle commentary by Gareth Reese of Hebrews. He's the same writer who I did when we did when we studied Galatians. I really think that he's a great writer. I just love how he organizes things, makes it so that I can really break it up into easy to digest chunks. You can find him on Amazon. He doesn't have any electronic. You have to actually buy his book, but I don't mind having it. It's a worthy read, and there's so much information in it. He does such good background. I wish I had had this a week earlier, so I could have Dean and I could have used it as part of the background setting up for Hebrews, because he spends probably the first 40 or 50 pages just laying the foundation for why Hebrews was written. And there's just so much information about that. Not that we know who wrote it or that we can say specifically when it was written, but those things aren't important. We know why it was written and to whom it was written. And those are the most important things about Hebrews.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Any other comments or questions? Okay. That's all I had for tonight. I know it was a shorter meeting tonight. We got about 15 minutes from what we normally have, but don't expect it to be that way every Wednesday evening. I expect I'm going to go longer most of the time. So I just wanted to just start into Hebrews, just a real slow and very descriptive start of what Hebrews is about. And that is how superior Jesus is and why he is better. And we're going to see that theme throughout this book. So be ready for that.
And it didn't look that way. If you were a Jew, you know, the priests that you were familiar with, that you interacted with, they walked around with the great flowing robes, and they had the position, they had the wealth, they had the power. Jesus came here. He was the son of a carpenter. He didn't even have a place to lay his head, he told one of the disciples. He was despised, Isaiah says. So even though he was better, he is, in fact, I should say, better than the angels, he was willing to give that up and to take on himself this incredible position as being lower than the angels, made a man like us for the suffering of death.
Absolutely. And we'll be seeing much more of this as we get into our study. So I hope this was just a taste for you of what we're going to be studying over the next couple of months, at least. We'll probably be well into February or March before we're done with our study of Hebrews, but it's just such an amazing study, and I hope you'll join us each and every week that you get a chance and an opportunity to be with us. Any other comments or questions for this evening?
I have a comment.
Go ahead.
I keep thinking just the prophets through God said that God was going to change things up. Like when he took everything away from them, he told them that he was going to change it up, that he was going to do something different to get people to come. So it's just really amazing to me that they had a hard time not accepting Jesus for who he was, and that he came from God.
Agreed. I don't know how you could walk around with the Son of God as a man and not be humbled by that. How did his apostles spend 3 years with him and not just absolutely be humbled to have been with him that entire time. I know they learned so much from him. And it's amazing to me that we see so many times that people would try to argue with Jesus and he would put them down. Not in a way that is demeaning or anything like that, but just so they could not respond. They did not have an argument that could defeat what Jesus had said. And he wasn't being mean. He wasn't being spiteful. He was telling the truth. And the truth is going to win each and every time. And we see that Jesus brought the truth. The way, he is the way, the truth, and the life. And that's exactly what he was his entire time on this earth. He was God's radiance shining for everybody to see. Any other comments for this evening? Dean, you're muted.
If you were having trouble getting the emails, check your settings, because sometimes I get blocked by the porn filters because of my last name. It comes out screws. So you just have to be careful and check your junk mail, check your settings to make sure. But I think Andrew and Kirsten were able to get the mail that I sent late. So you just want to check your junk and that kind of thing. And if you didn't get the invitation by about 6 o'clock, get back with me and I'll be sure that I get you the invitation.